Okay, well done, everyone. That was good. Better than me. What I'm going to do now, I'll just do this myself just to save a bit of time because it's already 8 o'clock. Eka undor barvexe in, oh, sorry, in one undumbara tree. Lage, there are. Koti vale, millions of fruits. Koti, millions. Ye, which, Brahmananda, of universes. Base, float. Virajara, of the Viraja River. Chale, in the water. Okay? Translation. Just as there are millions of fruits on the Undaba tree, millions of universes float on the waters of the river Viraja. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Viraja is a river that divides the material world from the spiritual world. On one side of the river Viraja is the effulgence of Brahmaloka and innumerable Vaikuntha planets, and on the other side is this material world. It is to be understood that this side of the Viraja River is filled with material planets floating in the causal ocean. The name Viraja indicates a marginal position between the spiritual and material worlds. But the Viraja River is not under the control of the material energy. Consequently, it is devoid of the three gunas. Eka undumbara vikshe lage koti fale koti e brahmanda base birajara jale. Okay. Om agyanam tiriram dasha granjala shalakaya jaksho om miritam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha shri titanya manobistam sapitam yena bhutale swayam rupa gramayam tadati svapadantikam he krishna karuna sindhu dinabandhu jagatpate gopisha gopika kanta radha kanta namostute vancha kaupa trubascha kripo sindhu badevacha patitanam pavanebhyo vaishnavebhyo namo namaha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pastaya Bhutale Srimati Bhaktivedanta Swaminiti Namine Namaste Sasvati Deve Gurvani Pracharine Nirvisesha Shunyavadi Vashachade Satadine Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Babu Nichananda, Sri Advaita Gadadha, Sivasadi Gaura Bhaktavrinda, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. Wow, beautiful verse actually here. Just as there are millions of fruits on the Udumbara tree, millions of universes float on the waters of the river Viraja. So, okay, so of course, the first thing we'll do is, as I mentioned, the verse 171, we'll try and do this in sequence of the verses. Brahma Samhita, of course, as we mentioned, 554. So, the purport, of course, by ISKCON's grandfather, if you like, Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur, on this verse, he writes, karma, though without beginning, is still perishable. The karma of those who work with the hope of enjoying the fruits of their labours becomes everlasting and endless and is never destroyed. The function of sannyas is also a sort of karma befitting an ashram, and it is not pleasant to Krishna when it aims at liberation or the desire for liberation. Those who are pure devotees always serve Krishna by gratifying his senses, forsaking all attempts of karma and jnana, and being free from all desires save that of serving Krishna. Krishna has fully destroyed the karma, its desires and nescience of those devotees. It is a great wonder that Krishna, being impartial, is fully partial to his devotees. So this is quite a different subject to the Viraja River, which we'll get into in a moment. But I think the purport of this purport is quite clear. Even if someone is a renunciate or a yogi, or even a sannyasi, if their pure intent is purely for their own liberation, you know, achieve moksha, even if that intent is I want to be liberated, I want to be close to Krishna, that's tainted and that is not pure bhakti. But pure bhakti is, Krishna, I want to love and serve you, even if I'm doing it from hell or Watford, you know, whichever is close. In other words, I'm with you, whether I'm in this serving in this material world, serving in a lower planet or something, or serving in heaven, or serving directly in the spiritual world, I'm happy while serving you. In other words, pure bhakti means selfless without any type of liberation. You know, so even a great Muni or whoever in meditating in caves and so forth, admirable that as that is, the pure science to actually cross over this river, if you like, of illusion, is actually to engage in loving service, devotional service to a person. And beyond this impersonal Brahma Jyoti, of course, many of those who are seeking mystic siddhis, yogis who, especially in the former yugas actually, who perform, even today, perform austerities to receive some mystic siddhis is not the perfection, nor is it to become a great scholar. Of course, all these are good. It would be useful to have some mystic siddhis, wouldn't it? Or, of course, to be very learned. However, to, and of course, other forms of jnana or karma, in other words, good action. Those that are performing good activities to receive good karma. Okay, these things are, by definition, good. You know, they're good. So one of the gunas, the highest guna, is good. But without bhakti, it's not enough to liberate you, you see. Ultimately, even if one is going to merge into the personal Brahma Jyoti at the time of death, through understanding that the understanding of God as an energy or sense of oneness, as opposed to a person that you serve, even if one enters the Brahma Jyoti, it is described that sooner or later you have to re-enter the material world, because the living entity's constitutional position is not actually God. We are the energy of God, for sure. We are a chincha beta beta tattva, simultaneous oneness and difference with the personality of Godhead. But there is that difference as well, you see. Because without that difference, there is no love. If the spiritual world is full of love, well, the spiritual world, given that it is full of love, means you need to have one plus. You need to have more than one entity. If there's only God that exists, and that's, I mean, in one sense, God is everything. He's the origin of everything. Krishna is the origin of all the Vaikuntha planets, origin of all the Narayan forms, origin of all the Vishnu forms, origin of the material world. Yes. But there's also different personalities within that matrix, if you like, spiritual material matrix. Because of relationships and reciprocation is a very important factor of existence. And without relationships, there is no love. You know, love means something that it means one, and then you love another one, and that this one reciprocates. So without that sense of at least some duality, I mean, we get into the philosophies of Ramanujacharya and Madhvacharya at a different time. But the sense is, the Gaudiya philosophy is that there's simultaneous, inconceivable oneness and difference between the living entities, which is us, the souls, and the personality of Godhead. He's the origin of all. We are the same quality as Krishna, but the quantity is a bit different. So that's kind of the karma. Yeah, but if you're performing Vedic rituals for karma, for good luck, you know, for your own benefit. Culturally, these things are kind of, you know, anything in the mode of goodness, I suppose, is good. But it's not going to liberate you. It's not going to get you beyond the Viraja River, that dividing line between the spiritual and material world. The only way you can cross that river on a permanent level, you know, swim across, it's metaphorically speaking, you know, swimming across, is through bhakti, you see. But you can get across, but you might find yourself in the Brahma Jyoti. So you've cheated. You haven't really done any, you know, you've just crossed a bridge, but you've still got to spring back again. Anyway, what's interesting, I felt, moving on through the verses, which I think is quite interesting. Often we read things, but we're dealing with different analogies and things like that. And sometimes from in the modern world and the modern culture, and perhaps in the West especially, some words are difficult for us to truly understand. Like, for example, in 170, from the heavenly King Indra down to the smallest insect, an Indragopa. So, because what is an Indragopa? What is that? You know, if I saw an Indragopa, I mean, had a we call it a magnifying glass or something. Generally, Indragopas are kind of tiny little red insects, tiny little things, and maybe it's a Kali Yuga thing, I know, but often they're used to crushed to make red dye. So they're pretty small. I don't know if that was always the case, but and whether or not that's the actual insect, but it's a very, very small, tiny little red insect that you can't see with the naked eye. So that's an Indragopa. And then we find out about the Udumbara tree, which is, I believe, is according to my search on Google, so it must be true. It's a kind of fig tree. And on those fig trees, the figs, obviously it's a fig tree, quite small figs compared with, let's say, other species of fig trees. They're quite small and they grow in groups. And, you know, I guess just like grapes, only smaller, really. So there's many of them, but... what's interesting, I feel, that it's described that there are millions of universes in this material cosmic manifestation. And yet, a Ndumbara tree would have probably about maybe a couple of thousand, but not millions. However, in verse 176, which is four verses later, which maybe someone will talk about next week, so I'll just kind of cheat a little bit, this is, it reads, Maya and her unlimited material universes are situated in the causal ocean. Indeed, Maya appears to be floating like a pot filled with mustard seeds. And of course, each mustard seed is a universe. So this at this point, we can imagine millions. Often it's described, especially if someone goes to a market in India, or sometimes you get these bags, the bags are open, you know, you get these... And you see it's full of mustard seeds. And that's, and if you see it, each mustard seed is maybe, I don't know, a quarter of a millimetre in diameter. And it's a lot. It's a lot. However, the fact that in the... It's also described that the universes sometimes are in clusters, which is more reminiscent of the of the fig tree analogy. So we put these two together, and it, these verses together, and it's quite an interesting picture we get of the nature of these... universes. There's a lot of them. They're all quite similar, at least from the outside, and they're in clusters. Fascinating analogy. So the Viraja River, Viraja means stainless, pure, you know, splendor. In other words, it's not contaminated by the three modes of material nature. You're on your way out. If you can get that far, you are making spiritual advancement. You've got to cross it and you've got to stay the other side of it through bhakti. But nevertheless, it is a... You have, sometimes, you see, you imagine that you're living in a village, one side of a river, and on the other side of the river, there's another village. But the two villages are very different places because the river would... There's no bridge, you see. So therefore, you know, in that situation, the two villages don't have much contact with each other, especially if it's a very wide, you know, if it's like a very wide river. And therefore, you know, in terms of classical geography, mountains and rivers are always there and are analogies which mean just as much as us to today as it did thousands of years ago. These are geographical truths that all, it doesn't matter how many mobile phones we have, but there's always going to be mountains and rivers for us to understand. But it kind of represents the boundary between the spiritual and the material worlds. Let's see, here's a summary of what Srila Prabhupada, he says, it's like a dividing line, lies at the edge of the material cosmos, separating the mahatattva, the material energy, i.e. that what is not, the untruth. It's what exists, but it's not, people are not living in truth inside the mahatattva, this material world. and separates that from the parabjoma, the spiritual sky, Vaikuntha, the place without anxiety. On one side is the world of birth and death, on the other is the eternal spiritual realm, and we know which one is which, of course. It doesn't necessarily mean it's a physical river like the one we see on Earth. Sometimes the word river or mountain, mountain, Everest or Snowdon in Wales or Ben Nevis or whatever, you know, Mount Blanc, you know, mountain. But it doesn't necessarily mean it's the same as that. But it's it gives us an idea, you know, some block, some or river, something that is a dividing line between one kingdom and another or one village and another. That requires qualification to cross, like a bridge. Shishirada Gulhanand Ki Jai, Sitaram Lakshman Hanuman Ki, Shashigonitai Ki Jai. So the Viraja River is sometimes described as the causal ocean or the Karana ocean. And that's why we have Karana Dakshai Vishnu, who lies. In fact, there's a picture over there, just by Purujana Prabhu's head. When he wakes up, we can see, you know what I'm talking about. So you can see there's Mahavishnu, or sometimes it's called Mahavishnu, or more accurately, perhaps Karanadakshai Vishnu, is there lying in the Mahatattva, this corner of the spiritual sky, the Vaikuntha. It's just one corner, just like you've got a prison in one corner of a city. So this material world is like the prison, but it's part of the town planning because there's going to be criminals, and that's us. but there's a prison warden, you see, or there's someone who's maintaining it, and that is Karanadakshai Vishnu. And as he breathes in and out, all these different universes, like mustard seeds, are coming in and out of the pores of his skin each time he breathes, and he is half asleep, semi-conscious, I guess, just as we're semi-conscious. And each breath is a huge, huge period of time. Remember, in the spiritual world, the other side of that Viraja River that we need to cross at some point, there is no time. That's one of the differences between the spiritual and the material. In the spiritual world, there is no colour. There is no time as we experience time. There's past times. You know, there is the sense of occurrence where this happened and then Krishna does this, then Krishna does that, or Krishna dances with the gopis, or Krishna whatever. But that's not the material time. There's occurrences, but time for us means beginning, middle and end, and then round again, cyclic time. So similarly, as Mahavishnu is Karanadakshai Vishnu is breathing in and out the pores of his skin, that is like the single original point of time, where the universes have a beginning when they're coming out of the pores of his skin, and when he breathes in, they start to die, and then boom, like that. For him, it's just one breath. In reality, actually, it's just one breath. That's it. Meanwhile, by earthly calculation, 311 trillion Earth years goes by. Actually, 311 trillion, 40 billion Earth years. So we're pretty small in comparison. And still, we still try to play God. Oh dear. How is it possible? Because it is ego that has brought us here. Interestingly enough, as Mahavishnu or Karanadakshai Vishnu is entering and doing this breathing, he glances at Pradhan, which is the unmanifest material nature, but he impregnates it. The personification is feminine, actually, which is Durga Devi, the mother nature, actually. And that actual glance of Mahavishnu contains the jivas. With his x-rays, and the personification of that glance is Lord Shiva, or Sadashiva, the greatest original Lord Shiva, is actually non-different from the glance of Lord Vishnu upon this material energy, which is fascinating, really, when you think about it. So as this happens, we know, of course, from in terms of creation, once this is happening, then because there's millions and millions of different universes, then Karunadayakshaya Vishnu expands himself into each and every one of those millions of universes. And each of those universes is half filled with the Garbhadaka ocean. And on all those different Garbhadaka oceans, of which there are millions, Vishnu appears as Garbhadakshaya Vishnu, where he's lying on the Anantashesh, and of course there's Lakshmi there massaging his feet. And there he is again, just kind of relaxed, a bit detached actually. And there's millions of them. And there's millions of them, just like there were millions of universes. And out, of course, the navel comes this lotus stem. Of course, we all know this anyway, but it's good to be reminded. And at the top of that manifests this lotus flower, which is the seat of Lord Brahma. But of course, it's kind of multi-dimensional, because we know that Lord Brahma couldn't see Lord Vishnu. He doesn't like peer over the lotus flower. Oh, there he is. Because he was surrounded by darkness. It doesn't mean he wasn't there. It just means it is obviously the best way we can possibly comprehend is this. So, yeah, so there's millions of Lord, there's millions of universes, and there's millions of Lord Brahmas, a different Brahma in each universe. And of course, we have our Brahma, who's a devotee at least, you know. Most, I think, of the Brahmas are devotees, but not necessarily all. There's different. Each one is a different jiva, you see. So each one has a different personality as well. Anyone feeling small yet? I am. But even Lord Brahma is so much more powerful compared to us. Again, it's unbelievable. I guess we're a little bit like Indra Gopas in comparison. Just like insects. For them, how long they last. Some insects are so small that from our calculation, they may just live a few hours. We go to bed, we go to sleep, some insects are born. By the time we wake up the next morning, the insect has lived, grown up, reproduced and died. So this is us, actually, in comparison with the gods and demigods. Because Lord Brahma, his lifetime, for him, it feels like about 100 years. For us, it's a breath from Mahavishnu. You know, so he, just a day for Lord Brahma is 4.32 billion years by our calculation. So the whole history of, at least according to modern science, the whole history of the Earth, if you like, is just this one day of Lord Brahma, one kalpa. And Prabhupada, or the Vedic scriptures, describe that each kalpa is divided into 14 manvantars. And each manvantar, there's a different manu, a different progenitor of mankind, or a different Indra as well, actually. So it's like a change of guard, just like different government. Every few years, there has to be another election. Sometimes it can't come too soon. Sometimes it's like there's another election, or there's another partial devastation in between each manvantara. So in between each kalpa, day of night time of Lord Brahma, there's pretty much a full devastation. Even in most of the heavenly planets, certainly the Earth, it's uninhabitable. There's not much going on. But during the daytime of Lord Brahma, everything comes to life again. So we're kind of about nearly halfway through this particular day of Lord Brahma. And Lord Brahma, by his calculation, is about 51. He's about 51. So often they depict Lord Brahma with a beard. But I'm older than 51, between you and me, but I don't have a beard because I shave, but Lord Brahma has a beard. I mean, if I didn't shave, I'd have a beard, wouldn't I? Most men would, I think. So Lord Brahma, he's about 51, relative to his experience. But for us, that's still about 155 something trillion years. So he's kind of, and he's got around that amount left. Now the Vedic scriptures actually give a list of 30 names of different kalpas. And, you know, so in other words, another 30 days of Lord Brahma. So it's a huge periods of time that's actually in reality beyond our comprehension. But I think we are the Sveta Vraha Kalpa. our particular day is called the Freitas, which means the white boar, you know, the boar incarnation of the Lord, Vraha, the boar. So this is the Kalpa, the day of Lord Brahma, that is connected to the white incarnation of Vraha. In other words, at the very beginning of this day, Lord Brahma, the earth was in devastation. Lord Vraha picked up the earth with his tusks, and therefore the day began. So this is the understanding. That's why it's called the Sweta Vraha. People get mixed up, though. You know that. Because there's actually two Vrahas in this day of Lord Brahma. There's the white one, which I've just described, and there's the red one, the one who's a bit more angry. You know that one is? That's the one that rescues the earth and also has a fight with Hiranyaksha. But the different incarnations of the Lord, these Purusha avatars, these Das avatars actually, one of the things, if you take a literal understanding approach to when they appeared, it's actually mind-blowing. And I think the word mind-blowing is appropriate, because it's understood that happened, the Hiranyakashipu was at the beginning, roughly, of the last Manvantara, the sixth Manvantara, Chakshusha Manu, which in English language, that means that there was about over a billion years in between each Vraha. But often it's depicted as the same pastime, but actually there's a billion years in between. But the Lord can do that, because time is you know, Lord, he's experiencing time differently to us, as we know. But in reality, you know, you talk about each Manvantara is something like 308 million years long by our calculation. We're living in the seventh Manvantara. If there's 14, we're in number seven. So we're kind of middle of Lord Brahma's day, really. It's like midday for him. And each Manvantara is divided into 71 Yuga cycles. So it's like cycles within cycles. And each Yuga cycle, of course, is about just over 4.32 million, not billion this time, million years long. And each cycle is Satyadwapatrita Kali. In our cycle, the one we're in, which is the 28th one of this Manvantara, it's Satya Treta Dvapar Kali. Treta meaning three, it normally comes third, which is, again, a mind blower. It's a bit different for us in this Yuga cycle, because Krishna comes, you see, which he only comes in his original form once a Kalpa. So we're quite a unique Yuga cycle. Of course, different incarnations of the Lord come to help deliver mankind, to destroy, annihilate the demons and so forth, and uplift mankind in different cycles, different yugas. But Lord Krishna appearing in his two-armed original form is something quite unique, actually, in this yuga cycle. For those who are interested, according to Jiva Goswami, Lord Ram, for example, is said to appear in the 24th Yuga cycle of this Manvantara. So that was about four Yuga cycles ago. And if you get your calculator out, if you've got time, it means about 18 million years ago. So we're dealing with incredibly long periods of time. Often we try to squeeze everything into what we can comprehend, just like a small insect would try to judge its world relative to its experience. Similarly, we try to judge things according to our experience. But the Puranas are actually describing a universe which is huge, huge. I mean, just to give you an idea, even if you use mundane examples, but I think relative and interesting and relevant. Like, for example, the Greeks, their idea of how big the universe was probably roughly about the same size of our solar system or something. And then time goes by and their estimate of the size of the universe just got bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. Even in the 1920s, by about 19, they didn't know what a galaxy was before 1920. And they thought that was about the size of the universe. They, oh no, there's other galaxies. You know, there's, wow, hang on, this is big. At least by mundane calculation. So the estimates of not only of the estimates of space, but the estimates of time also have changed. I suppose, for example, the conception of the age of the Earth, or the age of the universe, again, it's getting bigger and bigger and longer each time. Even if you look at the some of the books by Jutakarma Prabhu, or a.k.a. Michael Kremer, The Hidden History of the Human Race, they're saying they've found modern human skeletons, you know, which don't fit into contemporary evolution theory. Actually, they're hundreds of, you know, thousands of years, if not millions of years old. They've even found tiny little spheres that are exactly spherical, with a kind of a little line drawn, like mini cricket balls. You've seen them, right? I've actually held one of them. They're quite small, about this big. They found them in rock that was going about a billion years old in South Africa, I think it was. But they are exactly spherical, and they've got a line on them which could have been made by some type of humanoid intelligence, let's say, a billion years old, which fits in very much with the Vedic, but does not fit in very well at all with the neo-Darwinism theory of evolution, which would put modern humans at about 200,000 years and that's it. But the Vedic conception of time is that, yes, we go through different periods, and yes, that those beings, primitive human beings, if you like, on the Earth, even in other yugas, that didn't cremate their dead, therefore leaving the bones behind. But there are advanced human beings as well on and off the world and in other parts of the universe, millions and millions of years. If we, you know, with a literal approach to Puranic time and space, it's a real mind blower, especially for a Saturday morning, you know. So when you're on Harinam tonight, Prabhu, in London, you can tell people all about the wonders of the universe. I'm sure they'll be very happy to hear from you. I mean, just to put things into perspective, there's even one verse in the Bhagavatam, which happens to be one of my favourite ones. It describes the pastime of Lord Buddha. And it says that Lord Buddha was preaching amongst the atheists and so forth. And then it says, when he was preaching, there were invisible space rockets in the sky. And it said that when the humans, they started to invade other planets, and there was a war going on, as you know, in the atmosphere of the Earth or wherever, as he was preaching. But Buddha's preaching was there to form a compromise between the theists and the atheists, and he stopped the war. And Prabhupada's purport is, that wasn't the most recent Buddha. That's not Gautama Siddhanta, you know, within our historically known, you know, there wasn't our Buddha, as it were. That was from another Kali Yuga. You know, several, whatever it was, Kali Yugas ago, within this Manvantara, but still millions of years ago. So Prabhupada, you know, the universe, the Puranic universe, the Vedic universe that Prabhupada is presenting to us is far out, but it's as it is. We just have to accept how small we really are, you know, like little insects, little red insects or whatever. And that whether you want to use the sense that of the mustard seed analogy, where we are our whole, you know, even the Lord Brahma would be small, because he's just inside one of those millions of mustard seeds coming from the, you know, the pores of Karadakshai Vishnu's body. Lord Brahma is small compared with the Lord. And what are we compared with Lord Brahma? So we are, really small. I mean, and yet, what keeps us inside the wrong side of this Ratta River is ego. We still want to play God. But is there a chance? I don't think so. Hirani Kashipu, Ravan, they all try to play God, but you can't play God. Because we're too small, we might as well surrender, really. we might as well surrender. But we think we're big, we think we're important. But we're only important. We are important when we're connected to the Lord, because the Lord is important. But on our own. Actually, whenever we, you know, it says in the Bhagavad Gita, you know, we can offer a fruit, a flower, some water, a leaf to the Lord, and he will accept it. It doesn't matter. He may accept that leaf more than accepting millions and millions of pounds, because he's more interested in the devotional attitude. You know, a few rupees from a poor man who's giving all he has is worth more bhakti than a billionaire who gives something in charity just to avoid the tax or something, you know, because it's the devotional aspect. Because Krishna doesn't need anything from us, but he still accepts it for our benefit and for that reciprocation, that bhakti, that that love that I was describing earlier. So what I wanted to do, just to finish off this morning, is just tell the story of... because after all that philosophy and all that mind-blowing stuff, we probably need to come down to earth a little bit, you know, on this planet. Actually, not even this planet, actually. You haven't heard the story yet. At least within this kalpa. The story of Devahuti and Kadama Muni. Because it's connected to cosmic issues. At the same time, it has a moral, a purport, if you like, a meaning that's relevant for us today. Because the beauty of the Srimad Bhagavatam, actually, the amazing thing, if you actually really analyze it, dissect it, it's talking about some of the highlights, if you like, from long, long ago, at least within this kalpa, this day of Lord Brahma. But all of them have lessons that are relevant in any yuga, even the Kali Yuga. For example, the story of Devahuti and Kadama Muni, it says you can enjoy the fruits of life, the fruits of family life, as long as you have the right consciousness, and still be detached, and then be liberated at the end. For example, Kadama Muni, he was exist in the first Manvantara of this kalpa, this. Swayambhuva Manu was the Manu of the time. Kadama Muni was extremely powerful yogi, as were many of his other offspring of Lord Brahma. There were great sages and rishis that existed actually at the beginning of this kalpa, but there was one problem. They weren't householders. They were not going forth and multiplying, just like the the four Kumaras. They were knowledgeable, they were smart, and they knew about the spiritual world, and they were full of mystic siddhis. But Lord Brahma said, look, guys, he may not have said that, but well, he might have, I don't know. He said, look, we've got a universe to deal with here, and we've got to populate it. So in that vein, Kadama Muni was performing severe austerities, to the point where one day he gets the blessings of Lord Vishnu, who comes down to see him on his Garuda Karya. It says, you know, there's obviously an exchange of prayers and respects that go on. And then Vishnu says, well, okay, here's the thing. Day after tomorrow, Swayambhuva Manu, and Manus were progenitors, right? Just like Daksha, it was their duty to go forth and multiply human races across the universe. He says, Swayambhuva Manu, you see, the thing is, Kadama, he's got a daughter, okay? And, you know, this happens today, doesn't it? He kind of needs to marry her off and, you know, well, you look like a suitable husband, so do me a favour. And Kadama Muni, of course, is not going to say no to Lord Vishnu, who's just made the effort to come and meet him. He says, yes, my lord. So Lord Vishnu disappears, goes back to Vaikuntha. Sure enough, just on time, in this great aerial chariot, followed by his retinue, Swayambhuva Manu, you know, the king of the time, he's kind of up there in the same category as Indra. He's kind of up, you know, in that degree of power. He's got his wife with him, and I think his daughter is there as well somewhere. They come down into the forest by the lake, and he He gets out of the chariot, walks respectfully into the hermitage of Kadama Muni and says, I've got this daughter. And, you know, you kind of qualified. You know, you're not in the saffron. You haven't made Prabhu. You're not a sannyasi Prabhu, you know. Maybe it's time for you to enter Grihastha life. And she's beautiful. Oh, yeah, she's beautiful. You've got to say yes. So Kadama Muni goes, he says, the thing is, you're destined to have 9 daughters. That's your destiny, because we need that. Because the sages then will have nice, beautiful wives that will attract them, and they will go forth and multiply across the universe. So it's all part of the plan, you see. Lord Brahma's king, yes. And Kadama says, okay, on one condition. After I fulfill, she's got 9 daughters, as prophesied, I just want to come back here again and continue with my meditation. He says, deal. So, of course, by the way, here's my beautiful wife. Oh, sorry, daughter. And she's now your wife. So after long goodbyes, again, something that would happen now, if a father's giving away the daughter, there would be a few tears, a few emotional exchanges. So that's what happened between Swayambhuva Manu and his daughter, Devahuti. But then Swayambhuva Manu and his wife have to return to their opulent kingdom, where he lived the rest of his life, well, without the anxiety of having a daughter for a start, but then he, you know, takes vanaprast, if you like, with his wife, and they live great, very opulently, but with that sense of detachment where he studies the sastra and takes association of the brahmanas, and that's how the rest of that manvantara proceeds. Meanwhile, Kadama Muni, of course, they've got this very loving exchange, but in the beginning, Kadama Muni, he's, you know, like if you've got a wheel on a bike, you turn it upside down and you get the, I did this as a kid a lot, you know, you get the pedals of the bike. What happens? The wheel goes. It takes time to slow down, doesn't it? It takes a bit of time. You can't, if you just put the brakes on it, but if you've got no brake, it takes, that wheel is going to go around, eventually it's going to slow down. So Kadama Muni was still basically a mendicant, is still a bit of a renunciate. So although his wife, Devahuti, was also living simply, just wearing simple clothes. Remember, she was brought up in a great kingdom with her father. She's a bit, you know, she'd kind of used to palaces, but she was also extremely in love with Kadama Muni, and she knew it was her destiny. However, Kadama Muni once opened his eyes and saw that she'd lost a lot of weight, and she wasn't, there was something missing there. I says, look, I'll tell you what we'll do. Let me reward you. By the way, I'm a mystic yogi. I can do what I like. So he goes. So out of his amazing mind power, he created this magnificent flying palace, which had full of rubies and sapphires and golden. There was playrooms. There was lounges. There was swans. There was cranes. This was like a huge, huge palace. But it was also a vimana. It could actually fly from one planet to another. No one could ever imagine how opulent it was, with all kinds of sapphires and rubies and couches and serving girls and dancers and hallways and reception rooms and carpets and corals. And she's like, wow, well, that's a present, you know. She said, but then she looked at herself, and she was all thin, and, you know, she was just wearing, you know, just sackcloth and whatever she was wearing. Kadama says, listen, I understand you don't feel worthy of entering this palace, but do me a favor, bathe in this lake. This is the Bindu Sarovar Lake, blessed by Lord Vishnu. That will sort you out. She says, yes, my husband. So she goes, dives in the lake, and there's all these celestial ladies there that take her to the underground kingdom, where they basically dress her up with, you know, nice new silk saris and flowers in her hair, flower garland, makeup, jewelry, you know, probably a bit of food as well to fatten her up a little bit. And she looks in the mirror. Meanwhile, Kadama Muni is there, probably just in meditation next to his magnificent celestial palace. But she's there, kind of getting waited upon, really, you know, having a, sounds like a good time. And she looks in the mirror, and what she sees, wow, now I'm ready, now I'm worthy to please my husband and please herself. So as soon as she thinks of her husband, though, mystically she appears back on the side of the lake where her husband was. And even Kadama Muni is kind of ready now. He says, "Well, okay, let's have a good time. You know, let's travel the universe. You're now ready. You're looking fantastic." So they climb above this magnificent golden Vimana palace, call it what you like. And for many, many years, they first of all go to the slopes of Mount Meru, with the heavenly planets, with huge, huge fruits that are like the size of elephants, and rivers full of mango juice, and there's angels, and there's Kiranas, and there's Gandharvas, and they fly to different parts of the universe for many, many thousands of years, at least by our calculation. They get a tour of the universe. They go from one heavenly planet to the other, and they have, and they're both beautifully dressed at this point, and they have a very good material time. But time, it was still in this material world. So what happened? Eventually, Kadama says, "You've seen the beauties of this universe. You've enjoyed it. You've met the celestial beings that are on these different planets. You've had a good time, basically. But now let's go back to where we started." And this was a difficult thing. They land back in their palace. He says, "I'm just going to continue my meditation." She says, "That was great, but what about the nine daughters?" Oh, yeah. So he says, Oh, yes. That slipped my mind. All right. Okay, nine. Okay, so he says, "Okay, time to get my magical powers back into action again." He splits himself into nine, like this. So there's nine Kadama Munis there. And in that way, I don't know how exactly it happened, probably best if I don't think about it, but she ends up with nine daughters that are all roughly, you know, the same age. Of course, these are like demigods when compared with us anyway. So even the process of 9 months pregnancy is not necessarily what they would have done. It would have been mystical. The fact that he's able to manifest himself nine times and have nine daughters from one lady as well is something beyond our experience. But nevertheless, he says, "Now I fulfilled my duty to Lord Vishnu, to Lord Brahma, and to Swayambhu Vamanu. You enjoy yourself." And she's like, "Okay, great. I've got this nice palace. I've got these daughters to keep me company. There's so many wishes and well wishes, but I need strength. I'm still very much attached to you. Do not worry. There's something else. You know, nine daughters, but also you're going to get a son." And soon after that, as Kadama Muni, of course, ages and continues his meditation, soon after, in the womb of Devahuti, Lord Vishnu, because it was a miraculous birth, in her womb is Kapiladev, another incarnation of the Lord. When he is born, he, of course, is an incarnation of the Lord, and he propagates the Sankhya philosophy, and he ends up protecting her and teaching his own mother, Devahuti, of course, the science of self-realization. So she's happy. And meanwhile, Kadama Muni eventually, of course, as we all must do, even the great demigods of the universe, Kadama Muni passes away. And he enters where? He enters Vaikuntha to be with his Lord Vishnu. So that's the story, in summary, of Devahuti and Kadama Muni. But again, the moral of the story is that whether or not we are lasting millions of years, or we're demigods, or we are whatever we are, or small human beings, or tiny insects, we do have to be detached. So whatever enjoyments there are, we can become grihasthas, we can fulfill our duty within that ashram, we can even, you know, there is some enjoyment there, but it has to be conscious, there has to be Krishna conscious, as it was for Kadama Muni, because even though he was above this celestial palace, deep down he knew this is not going to last. It's great, but he was detached, you see, to the fruits of his own endeavour. In the end, all he really had was his relationship with Lord Vishnu. So similarly, it is not that we should falsely live in a hermitage or live in a cave or whatever, but actually we have to engage in this material world. And even if riches come our way and opulence come our way and nine daughters or whatever it was, there are obligations, but we have to engage it in Krishna's service. That is true bhakti, not false renunciation. confirmation. I think it's also time to stop as well. I think Vishnu's had enough now. But the you say, all right, well, don't mind. Okay, you've made your point. But the point is that so we engage in this material world, but we do it in a mood of bhakti, and that is a true sense of liberation. So thank you. I have to go now, but thank you very much for listening. Sri Chaitanya Charitamrita ki jai.